Honey, the power's out.
Flashlight's dead. Can't find batteries.
Hey, neighbors. Want to borrow my Star Patrol spotlight?
That flashlight lights up the whole house.
Watch. The Star Patrol can light up the whole neighborhood. It can illuminate up to a half mile away.
A half mile? That's insanely bright.
And the Turbo Boost increases brightness up to 100%.
Whoa, now that's insanely bright.
With 10 illumination modes, the Star Patrol is a flashlight, spotlight, floodlight, emergency light, and more. And with an ultra-fast USB power bank, you can even charge your phone with it. Plus, the Star Patrol is fully rechargeable and backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee.
So how do I get one of these Star Patrols?
Go to GetStarPatrol.com and you'll get it with free Turbo Boost, free shipping, and a money-back guarantee. Again, that's GetStarPatrol.com. GetStarPatrol.com.
Hey guys, I hope you had a great week. You know, something happened to me this week that has never, ever happened in my entire career. True story. 15 years as a journalist. I have to think about how old I am. But 15 years as a working journalist. And what happened to me this week has never, ever happened before. It's not a mimosa moment. We talked about that last week. A mimosa moment, you know, one of those times where you have to sit back and laugh at something that happened in your day. This is not a mimosa moment. This is actually a margarita moment. It's more serious. And I'll tell you about it in a second. But I really want to get to the news this week because the best description of the news cycle this week is highly charged. Hasn't it been? Right? You know, we're just going to get into it. We're going to take a deep breath. And this week's a good reminder that you never know where you'll wind up. You know, wherever you're going to begin a week, you never know when you're going to where you're going to wind up. And we started this week with news of the government separating children from those who illegally cross the U.S. southern border. And then we ended the week with new orders by the government to reunite those separated children with their parents or with their guardians or whoever they crossed with. And a lot happened in between. And a lot's going to happen in the weeks ahead. But this has been an inescapable story. You open up Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, or that you watch things in the news, you're listening to the radio. You can't escape it. And as a journalist, it's been a little frustrating for me. I think we've done a solid job on Smarter News. Of course, we wanted to do more at times, but we also wanted to be very disciplined with the information that we shared. Because a lot has happened to get us to the point where we're at. And presenting the appropriate context is really important that we have a strong understanding of how we got here. And I think that's really been missing from the news. Everything's been so charged that we just haven't paused for a moment. So for a little bit of a different perspective on this story, I want us to travel back in time together, okay? You know, the government says illegal border crossing spiked back in March. So my question this week is, well, what happened before or after that? Like, why March? And if you look at some of the numbers, it looked like border crossing jumped by about 10,000 in March compared to January and February. And listen, there can be all sorts of variables for that. It could be the season. It can be the weather. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons for a bump in March. But what I wanted to look at is to what actually happened in the U.S. government. You know, what happened on our side, stateside, back in March. And as I was looking back through the news, I saw some interesting things that I just wanted to share with you. So let's go back to March. I don't even remember where I was in March. Do you remember? Sometimes I don't remember where I was yesterday. So let's go back to March. So leading up to March, the president made this big State of the Union address where he announced, and it was a surprise, that he was open to granting citizenship to a very select group of children that had been brought into the country illegally when they were young. As long as that policy change was part of immigration reform, and as part of that immigration reform, the president wanted money to build a border wall because that's been something that he's talked a lot about over the years. Now, the president, after the State of the Union, set an arbitrary deadline for March 5th. Do you remember this? And he said, hey, by March 5th, Congress needs to make some sort of compromise on this, or I'm going to try to move ahead by myself. And of course, Congress didn't make the compromise, and so that didn't happen. And a few weeks later, at the end of March, Congress had this big spending bill debate. We were all wondering if the government was going to shut down. And there was an opportunity there to legislate some new immigration reform. That opportunity surfaced, and yet again, there wasn't any compromise. So we talked a lot about immigration, really, in the first 3 months of this year. But at the end of March, we had no compromise. There was no citizenship extended to anyone new, and there was no money for the wall. Remember that? The president wanted $25 billion. He did not get it. But construction in early April started on a fence. And you can check out in our summary, I linked to our card from early April that shows what this fence looked like. And it looks very much like a wall. So that started early April. And of course, around that same time, end of March, early April, we had that major story about a caravan of asylum seekers that arrived at the border. And I was looking back through this because some of the children that were separated at the border are from Central American countries. We do know that. And so the majority of the caravan of asylum seekers was from Honduras. And interestingly, I just read for the first time, one of the people in the caravan used to be a politician in Honduras, but she was fleeing because she said it was too politically unstable. Well, back at that time, the chief of the Rio Grande Valley sector for Customs and Border Control, this is one of the, you know, the busiest sectors for illegal immigration in the nation, he gave an interview to Reuters in early April, and he expressed some concern that the caravan would inspire others to do the same, and that we would still continue to see the spike in illegal border crossings that we saw previously in the weeks leading up to that. So that's sort of the stage for the last several months. And so here we are now dealing with this repercussion of a spike of illegal border crossings, and that is the children. And what's interesting is that the Trump administration now will confront a very similar legal battle to the Obama administration. And one legal expert actually told the Wall Street Journal that every administration in one way or the other since the 1990s, when this ruling was handed down by the court, confronted something to this effect, that every administration's been having to deal with this. And the court ruling is that you cannot have a minor migrant child more than 20 days in government custody. And right now, the children are in government custody 40 to 50 days on average. And normally, that 20-day mark is also important because it's not long enough for legal proceedings. So if you're going to hold a child legally while their, let's say their mother, goes through the legal process of questioning whether or not she can stay in America as an asylum, as being granted asylum, or has to be deported, that usually doesn't happen in 20 days. So the government, in this time crunch, and again, that's the same thing that the Obama administration confronted for different reasons. Remember, the Obama administration confronted unaccompanied minors coming across the border illegally with no guardians. And they had a huge problem of figuring out what to do with the kids to keep them safe and what to do next. We have some great numbers, by the way, on Smarter News that talks about what unaccompanied minors look like when we come to age breakdown and gender breakdown. And it's really important to take a look at that because it may give you a different picture of unaccompanied minors than what we've been seeing this week. So I encourage you just to take a look at that. But the Department of Homeland Security made also a very important announcement this week during a press briefing that one of the reasons why 500,000 families from Central America have stayed in the United States since 2013 is because of this court ruling, because they had to remove the children from government care. And quite frankly, from what my understanding of the information is, parole the families to return to court at a later date because they could not hold the children for longer than 20 days. And so they would be matched with a family, the sponsor family, usually 90% of the time it's someone that the child knows in America. And so that's why so many have been allowed to stay, because the legal process just can't keep up with the volume. So that's something to watch in the week ahead, the weeks ahead, quite frankly. The president made a reference to that, of some sort of legal showdown. This is what he was talking about, because the timing of this and the ability to hold children conflicts. And that's where we're at. But remember, things change. You know, this week in the news, we learned a lot about changing traditions in America. One of them is that, you know, baseball, America's favorite pastime at one time. Well, attendance has dropped sort of mysteriously. And then we were looking at another story, marijuana. You know, in the past, it was a huge legal no-no, right, to smoke marijuana, possess marijuana. And now it looks like there might be some room for marijuana laws to change on a broader level, which is interesting. We also saw that the tradition of Americans watching television is really being challenged. And sooner than experts thought, Americans will spend more time online than they will watching TV, which is a big deal in America because nearly all of us own a TV. One American tradition I can say that we can depend on, though, of course, is our constant debate on certain issues. But just remember this as well, because this week we celebrated the first U.S. woman astronaut in space, Sally Ride. It happened 25 years ago. We talked a little bit about the plague, you know, something that we've been able to contain in America. That's because there was a case of the plague that emerged in Idaho from a child. But in general, you know, we don't have to worry about that in America anymore, not like other places. And we also learned for the first time that Americans have given more than $400 billion to charity. That's pretty incredible. So the diversity of our accomplishments should also show us that what seems impossible may actually be the next headline. So that's something we're going to watch for at Smarter News. So I had a bit of an adventure this week. I was so excited because I had something really special to show you, and it's from our trip that we took to New York City as a family. We hadn't been back as a family since we moved out of New York City, so this was a really big deal. And our kids happened to be really obsessed with the Statue of Liberty, so I have a 3.5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I thought, well, we'll just go down to the base of Manhattan and we'll just look at the Statue of Liberty. That's going to be totally fine. But my husband was like, no way. We totally are bringing the kids to the Statue of Liberty. And I was a little reluctant for obvious reasons about what that was going to look like. But I did something on a whim and I emailed a man that is extraordinary. One of my favorite interviews of all time. And his name is Barry Moreno. And he's a librarian and historian at the Statue of Liberty National Monument and at Ellis Island. And I talked to Barry over the years just to get some really good historical context on immigration. And I thought, you know, if I'm there, maybe I can meet him. Wouldn't that be great? And better yet, maybe I can interview him, which would be awesome. So early on Wednesday morning with the kids, we head out to Liberty Island. Several meltdowns later, we end up on Ellis Island. And I had emailed with Barry and I wasn't quite sure we were going to meet, but then he showed up and it was amazing. You know, Barry comes in, he comes bopping into the library where I met him, and he's like super energetic and vibrant. And I'm so excited to talk to him. And I've done interviews this way, using my computer and a special microphone for a myriad of different people, including another historian whose interview I have held for you for a couple weeks from now. So we're sitting in this library, this memorial library in Ellis Island, Barry and I, and we're in this amazing room. Let me just paint the picture for you. It's this big open space where the ceiling is skylights. The entire ceiling is glass. And the walls are really high. They're probably like 20 feet high and brick. And there's these big long tables that looks like out of a movie where you can sit at and do research. And that's where Barry has his office. And so we were sitting there and we're talking, having my microphone out and my computer, and the glass ceiling is sort of creaking and the doors are sort of slamming, but it's quiet because we're in this library during this very busy tourist season at Ellis Island. And so Barry and I start talking, I start recording, and I noticed that something was going on with my computer. So I had to stop and we started again, and everything was going good. I was stopping periodically to save my information because I wanted to make sure that I didn't lose anything. And so we had this incredible conversation that lasted over an hour, and check everything looks good. I leave, I go home. And this is what happened to me that it's never ever happened in my entire career. I get home to the hotel and I open up my computer and my computer is pinwheeling. You know, the pinwheel of death, you know what that's like. And I call Apple support because I know that I've recorded this amazing interview, and I explain to them the situation, and they're like, it's going to be fine. You're going to have to force quit, but you're going to have your information saved. And of course that happens. I force quit. And when I open everything back up, Nothing is safe. Zero. I lost everything. And that's what's never happened in my career. Like, I've never gone into an interview and lost everything. I mean, I've certainly had technical problems in the past, but I've never been wiped out completely. And it not only wiped out my interview with Barry, but a few other things that I had recorded. So it was catastrophic. I mean, it made me sick, like physically ill, because I was so proud to be able to have this interview that really gave some important historical context on a week when we really could use it. So I wrote Barry, told him what happened, and said, listen, I'd love to do an interview with you again, but I totally understand if you never want to speak to me. Lucky for us, he said he will speak with me again. And I think I have a way to do this from afar with more of a backup plan, which is something I should have had in place anyway. So you live, you learn, but man, it can be painful. And that's why I was saying this isn't just a mimosa moment. This is like a really serious moment. So I'm apologizing to you because I really wanted to have something incredible this week, but I still have my notes from the interview. And so what I would like to do is share with you the three top things I learned from Barry on immigration in general, having nothing to do with politics. This is just learning about how immigration has operated in America over the years. It really surprised me. I think it's going to surprise you. And I want to share with you these three points. And then when Barry does come back and we do an interview together, I was thinking about this. I bet you have some really interesting questions about immigration. What we think of immigration in the past often isn't the truth. And so I'd like to give you the opportunity to get some of your questions answered. And so I thought maybe you can email me and I'll use some of your questions in this interview with Barry Moreno, which would be such a rare opportunity to have the guy who has spent 25 years plus on Ellis Island making sure that we're telling the right story about immigration available to all of us here at Smarter News. I just think that would be amazing. So you can email me info@smarternews.com, and you know, just don't censor yourself. Like, just whatever you want to learn, like, I want to hear about it. So email me, we'll get that interview up with Barry, and in the meantime, here are my top three takeaways. So here's number one. The first person ever processed through Ellis Island was actually an unaccompanied minor, believe it or not. Now, I have to put quotes around that, unaccompanied minor, because she did enter the country legally, but she was under the age of 18. And right now, we consider anyone that comes into the country under the age of 18 an unaccompanied minor, unless, of course, they're with their family. But when they're separated from their family, they're called an unaccompanied minor. So the very first person processed through Ellis Island is a teenage girl with the name Annie Moore. And she traveled with her two brothers on a 12-day journey from Ireland to New York City. So she was 17. Her two younger brothers were much younger than her, and she was responsible for them. And she was processed through Ellis Island on January 1st, 1892. And she came to be reunited with her parents who were already here. And so she had this sort of amazing experience as being that first person that walked through the doors, if you will, of Ellis Island. And it's interesting to look at her history. Barry points out to me that she lived a very typical immigrant history here in America. You know, she married a German-American husband. She spent her entire life in an immigrant community on the Lower East Side of New York City. She had 10 children, 10. And so here she was, Annie. You know, she was both exceptional and very typical, because she was exceptional as the first person to go through Ellis Island, but very typical in the life that she led after it. And what's interesting to note is that children arrive by themselves, not all the time, but they definitely arrive by themselves to Ellis Island like Annie did. And many, many arrive with their mothers, and their mothers were without their husbands or other family members. So, you know, a child could come through Ellis Island with an uncle or with an aunt or with a mom. And I asked Barry, I said, well, how did they know that? And they, I mean the government officials, how did they know that that particular child belonged to the person they were with? And this is interesting because Barry said to me, well, you ask a few questions and you know. You know, the officers that were stationed at Ellis Island were empowered to make some decisions like that. And so, you know, since it was very typical that families traveled this way, they were allowed to legally enter America most of the time. Now, if they were detained for any reason, if the child was under the age of 16, they would be allowed to stay with their mothers on Ellis Island, or their mothers would be allowed to stay with them, which is one of the reasons why the women's ward in particular was very crowded, because if a child or a mom had to stay, they had to stay in that particular ward. So I thought that was a really interesting takeaway. The first person ever through Ellis Island, in fact, a child. 17, but considered a child. Even to today's standards, right? You know, you can't vote. You can barely drive. And so there she was, Annie Moore, going down in history. Now, the second thing that Barry taught me, which I thought was kind of blew my mind. He said, well, you know, illegal immigration hasn't always existed in America. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, clearly, illegal immigration is something that's always existed. And he's like, no, like, that's not true. There was no such thing as an illegal immigrant, especially before the Civil War. If you wanted to come to America, you came to America, you know? And of course, all sorts of issues surfaced with that. Because as immigration became more vibrant, especially in big cities, then you had everything that comes along with people flowing into the cities. So you have crime, you have crowding, you have disease. And this was really bad for the immigrant, Barry said, but also for the city and the state, because you had, you know, a lot of people flowing in and you didn't necessarily know who they were, and they were victims of crimes, or they could be criminals. And so there was all sorts of issues. And New York City actually developed the first immigration center in the nation. And it wasn't Ellis Island. It was this place called Castle Gardens. And that's where immigrants would come. They would register very basic information. And, you know, wherever they entered, whatever port they were in, they, you know, wherever they arrived in New York City, they would come to Castle Garden. They were supposed to come to Castle Garden. And I thought this was a really interesting point that Barry Moreno mentioned. He said, you know, one of the ideas behind knowing who people are, you know, not only with their name, where they arrived, you know, maybe they would learn a little bit more about them. Are you a Methodist, for example? Are you a Presbyterian? They might learn a little bit of something about this individual that arrived. Then the government would be able to link that person to a non-governmental agency, like a charity or a church. And so that person would not be suddenly all alone in the city, which would make them very vulnerable, not only for crime, but having to go on, you know, we the term welfare we're using much differently now. We have a different idea, but I'm using welfare and the idea that there were poor houses that the city ran. And so hopefully, if you linked this immigrant with another group or community that wasn't the government, they would have a better experience. And so that's something that New York City did. And I thought that was really interesting. Also, it's important to note that a lot of people that came to New York City, and a lot of people that came through this first immigration center, didn't stay in New York City. New York City had this, you know, the huge railway system, and so they would instantly move off into some other place. But this kind of set the stage for Ellis Island in some capacities. In fact, what Barry said is that the federal government actually wanted to buy Castle Gardens, and seems like there was a lot of resistance from the state, which actually leads into the next point that Barry taught me, which I thought was really crucial and totally changed the way that I thought about immigration. You know, immigration was not originally a federal government issue. Can you believe that? I mean, think about that. Immigration was not a federal government issue. In fact, states like New York and California, who had a lot of immigrants, did not want the federal government involved. And part of the reason was just philosophy. Like, what is the federal government know about what's happening in New York State, right? Like, the federal government wasn't emailing. They weren't, like, you know, FaceTiming. They were far away. And so New York State and New York City felt like they could handle the immigration issue. And also, Barry explains to me that, you know, the federal government did not have a lot of resources, especially in the early 1800s, to handle immigration or contribute to immigration in any way. So it's sort of this mutually beneficial relationship. Hey, states, you're going to handle, cities, you're going to handle immigration. The federal government's going to do something. You know, we're not. We're going to be hands off. But several things happened. And one of them being the Civil War. Now, the Civil War, Barry says, is very important for immigration, because where the states were suddenly very powerful before, the Civil War sort of changed the paradigm in America, where the federal government did gain power of saying, hey, we can actually tell the states what to do. That was important. But also there were some court cases that came before the Supreme Court, and they came from several different areas. And part of the court cases, and this is kind of going through the 1800s, had to do with states taxing immigrants or levying fees on immigrants or certain regulations on immigrants. And the Supreme Court, and I'm generalizing here big time, but the Supreme Court's rulings on this were fairly consistent in saying immigration is a foreign affairs issue and foreign affairs is a federal government issue. And so this is where the federal government can step in. And the federal government and Congress started making immigration laws. And there's a little bit of a key to this, though. Remember that the courts were taking up these cases that had to do with fees on immigrants. Well, the federal government realized that they could levy a fee on immigrants. And I've seen different reporting on this. So I just want to put a little asterisk by it. I've seen that some of these fees may be paid by steamship companies. So this ship that you arrived with would pay your fee rather than you would hand over a fee when you went through Ellis Island, for example. But the federal government figured out a way to make some money. And this is how they were able to support what would become federal immigration. And so that was very key. But it's interesting to think of the fact that as a U.S. citizen, if you were ever talking about immigration, you weren't really talking about the federal government. You were talking about your local affairs. I thought that was really, really interesting. So at the end of our interview, I asked Barry about the most important takeaway for him that he feels is missing from the current immigration debate. And his answer, just like everything else, is fascinating. I really can't wait for you to hear him in person. He's really a unique storyteller. And he said, as a historian, he feels two things really stand out. He said, over the years, you have to remember that immigration is really about betterment, that that's a consistent theme. It's about the betterment of American society. And different generations interpret this differently. Some we're going to judge in different ways, but it's a theme that in general, immigration policy was about the betterment of society. And he said, the second thing is that we have to remember that the role of the federal government has changed dramatically over the years. You know, it's a new acceptable idea, Barry says, that as the American public, we're looking to the federal government to solve immigration issues, where in the past, it would be not natural for us to think that. You know, we would think about the federal government as removed, as isolated, you know, and not very powerful. And now we don't think about it that way, right? We think about the federal government as really powerful. I know I do. And I think about, well, how is the federal government going to solve this issue at the border? I mean, clearly it's under the federal government's purview. But we've, over the years, and I'm sure you've seen over the last, you know, recent decade, that periodically states challenge us and say, hey, we're going to come up with our own law about immigration or immigrants in our state. And it goes to the Supreme Court. So we're going to see this face off. But I think Barry's reminder that, hey, it hasn't always been the federal government's going to solve this is a really important reminder. And it makes me think, well, what other creative solutions are out there that have nothing to do with the government? Is there a creative solution to immigration reform that the government has not been able to achieve that doesn't exist in government? I'm thinking about that. So anyways, those are my three takeaways. Barry Moreno's the bomb. That's the other takeaway. And I'm really excited for you to hear the voice of this extraordinary storyteller. I really think he's a national gem. I'm not just saying that, Barry, if you're listening to me. I'm not just like, this is for real. I've talked to a lot of people over the years, and I love listening to Barry. And I'm so disappointed that the interview didn't get saved. But, you know, sometimes that happens. I always experienced that, you know, in live TV or even when I was publishing it, you know, rushing to publish a piece when I was working at a district newspaper, for example. Sometimes the stories don't make air or don't make press, and you have to think, okay, there was a reason for that. And we're going to try to do it in a different way. And when we do it, it's going to be the right time. And I actually think it's going to be the right time if I can better answer the questions that you want answered. So definitely email me. You know, again, avoid current politics. We're going to keep the politics out of it for a second because we really want to hear about immigration in the past. And email me info@smarternews.com for, you know, anything about immigration that you'd like to hear from Barry Moreno. And you know what? I'm going to throw in something. If we pick your questions, I'm totally going to send you some Smarter News gear. I mean, that's only fair, right? So send in your questions. If we pick your questions, we're going to send you some gear. I'm really excited about that. So we're going to figure it out. That's what I'm going to promise you. In the meantime, thanks for understanding. I hope you still find the takeaways interesting. And this is what journalism's about. You know, you got to go to the place. You got to sit at Ellis Island. Oh, and I forgot this last gem, by the way, and I'm going to leave it here, I promise. But you know the room I was telling you about where Barry and I sat? Guess what it was originally? It was actually an exercise room with an open ceiling for detainees at Ellis Island. So they'd be able to come to this little courtyard and just get some fresh air. But the walls were really high. Remember I said the walls were about 20 feet high? That's because they couldn't get out. And so now that small detention area is a really cool library. And that's kind of how fluid history is, right? What things are one day become something very different the next. Just something to think about. I hope you have a great day whenever you're listening to this. I'm so grateful for your time. And I look forward to answering your questions. And we are excited for the week ahead at Smarter News. Have a great one. I'll talk to you later.
Honey, the power's out.
Flashlight's dead. Can't find batteries.
Hey, neighbors. Want to borrow my Star Patrol spotlight?
That flashlight lights up the whole house.
Watch. The Star Patrol can light up the whole neighborhood. It can illuminate up to a half mile away.
A half mile? That's insanely bright.
And the Turbo Boost increases brightness up to 100%.
Whoa, now that's insanely bright.
With 10 illumination modes, the Star Patrol is a flashlight, spotlight, floodlight, emergency light, and more. And with an ultra-fast USB power bank, you can even charge your phone with it. Plus, the Star Patrol is fully rechargeable and backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee.
So how do I get one of these Star Patrols?
Go to GetStarPatrol.com and you'll get it with free Turbo Boost, free shipping, and a money-back guarantee. Again, that's GetStarPatrol.com. GetStarPatrol.com.